Welcome, everyone, to our third session on God's stories through Rembrandt's eyes with Jim Davison and Sandy Connolly. Now, Jim will open with prayer.
Good morning, everybody. Shall we pray? Gracious God, for this new day that you have given us in this world, we give you thanks for the blessings of being of life and the opportunity to know one another, the opportunity to serve you in this world. We do thank you. We pray that you might be with us in this class as we think again about paintings that Rembrandt has done. We pray for all that's going on in this church this day, that you might make it a blessing for all who attend and allow all to grow in our faith. Now be with us, we pray. We pray it through Christ's name. Amen. Everybody's arriving all at once. Hi. So in the last 2 weeks, obviously, we've covered the prodigal son painting by Rembrandt and also the denial of Peter last week. And I wanted to stick our friend up there again. For those, if anybody is here who was not here before, that is a painting of Rembrandt, a self-portrait of Rembrandt done at the age of 52. So well into his life. He lived about 10 or so, 15 years longer than that. In any case, that is him. And he was a great painter, as we know. We're going to see today that he also did etchings, and they are phenomenal as well. But we'll get to that in a moment. As we start, I once again want to read the passage from which all of this comes. And in this case, the painting, or rather the etchings that we will be looking at, are called the Three Crosses. And that obviously has to do with the crucifixion of Jesus. I want to read the passage from Mark 15. I chose that passage because it's the shortest. And some of them, like Luke, get very long. So this has the basic storyline. So the soldiers compelled a passerby who was coming in from the country to carry his cross. It was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Then they brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull. And they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided his clothes among them, casting lots to decide what each should take. It was 9 o'clock in the morning when they crucified Jesus. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And with him they crucified two rebels, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by derided him, shaking their heads and saying, "Aha, you who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests, along with the scribes, were also mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Messiah, the King of Israel, let him come down from the cross now so that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him also taunted him. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m. At 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthana," which means, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" when some of the bystanders heard it, they say, listen, he's calling for Elijah. And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come down to take him down. Then Jesus gave a loud cry, and he breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was God's son. There were also women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the younger and of Joses, and Salome. They had followed him when he was in Galilee, and they ministered to him. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. That last line, just real quickly, other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. Does anybody know why they said come up to him in Jerusalem? It's the normal language that is used because Jerusalem was on a mountain, Mount Zion, ultimately. But it became the technical thing that you just said. If you're going to Jerusalem, it doesn't matter whether you're on the mountain next to it. You're still going up to Jerusalem. You could be on Mount Everest, and the language would be, let's go up to Jerusalem. It's in all the texts. That's the way you read it almost all the time. In the Old Testament, there are psalms called Psalms of Ascent, the pilgrimage psalms when you went to Jerusalem, and they all talk about, let us go up to the house of the Lord and things like that. I just find that a really interesting phrase. This is extra. When I see it, and read it. So that's what it means. And now you'll never be able to forget it, probably. Well, this is the painting, or rather the etching. You'll see that there's a lot of detail there. This is about as good as we can get it for you all, given the size of it and so forth. I'll say this is what's called a third state, but I'm going to let Sandy take over now and describe all of that, because it becomes a little complicated in a few moments.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. And I'm going to start with just a bit of an overview. Rembrandt's prints were created entirely in the medium of etching and the related techniques of dry point and engraving. These are forms of intaglio printing. And the definition of that is where the ink is forced into grooves beneath the surface of the printing plate and transferred under pressure to a piece of printmaking paper. So under pressure, so there's a press, and then images are formed that way. So Rembrandt created some 300 etchings and dry points from about 1626 to 1665. His career as a printmaker ran parallel to his career as a painter. He was a great innovator and experimenter in this medium, often handling traditional materials in unconventional ways. So what you see is something, maybe the product byproduct of his experimentation. And his impact on printmaking is still reflected in etchings that are produced today. So now let's focus on the three crosses. So this is a dry point etching. The size is 17 inches by 15 inches. And there were four different editions or states. And in the art world, states refers to identical impressions that are printed from the same unchanged plate. So the Three Crosses was printed between 1653 and 1655, so over a two-year period. So we will concentrate on the third and the fourth states of the Three Crosses. And before it is asked, there was a first and second state of the design. Records indicate that 21 prints of the first state were pulled, and two still exist. And then Rembrandt changed the design slightly for the second state, and 10 prints of that are recorded, and two still exist. So what we see here is the third state, and just 22 prints are known to exist. Rembrandt signed and dated the plate at this stage. Rembrandt, you can see it down on the kind of toward the left a little bit on the very bottom. You can see his signature. It's barely visible, but it's there. And by signing it, he felt that this was the complete version of this print or this piece of art. So in this state, Rembrandt depicts Luke's account of the events at Calvary, which, as Jim said, were detailed. So I think I'm sure he read all the versions, but Luke's, there are just lots and lots of details. So the upper third of the print is filled with dark sky. Christ's crucified body is bathed in a shaft of glowing light. And he is flanked by the two crucified thieves. Beneath him are mourners, including Mary Magdalene, the disciple John, and the Virgin Mary, who has fainted in despair. To the left, the centurion kneels before the cross with his helmet removed. Now, Jim is going to highlight the figures during the lecture, so I will not spend time on details, but overall, the scene, I think, is filled with energy and drama. So also, in the interest of time, we won't do the exercise together of counting to five and opening your eyes, but I do encourage you to do that on your own at some point with both states of the etching that we will view. So Jim, would you change to the fourth state? Okay, here we go. So fast forward 2 years. The copper plate is in its third state was considerably worn. But Rembrandt wanted to make more prints of the Three Crosses. And so he reworked the surface completely, scraping off the burr and burnishing the image so that only ghost-like lines of the previous design remained. Now the burr is the raised piece of metal that forms on both sides of a line that is drawn with a cutting tool. Okay. He then etched a new and drastically different composition on top of the old design. Let's switch to another view that has both of these pieces side by side. Okay. So many of the figures were reimagined or removed entirely. Notice that Christ's appearance is altered, and large areas of the design are obscured. There were so many changes to this fourth state that for a long time, it was considered to be printed from an entirely different plate. With these drastic changes, Rembrandt shifts the moment in the story and creates an even more dark and dramatic biblical representation. Now, again, Jim is going to handle highlights and details, so I'm going to pass along to Jim right now.
That's the fourth stating, and you can tell by how dark it is, but we'll start now with the third to talk a little bit more about how this all worked and what was going on. The crucifixion, that whole event that took place that day, it's really complex. There's a tremendous amount going on. So that's actually why I didn't ask you to try to picture what you would paint while I read the scripture this week. There, we would spend the rest of the day just going over the things that are possible. But in any case, I'm also glad when I think about it, because this is so complex. So we have two things that Rembrandt did, which are similar, but somewhat different. He's giving two different perspectives. And that's a kind of neat thing that etching allows. If you can re-etch a plate and then, or turn it into a different etching, you can have similarities with a little bit of difference. And the other thing that strikes me about that is that's actually very similar to what the Gospels do. If you recall, if you read them side by side, all the Gospel accounts, you'll find that there's a lot of differences there. They're essentially giving four different perspectives, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, four different perspectives of Jesus, his life, the miracles he did, the crucifixion, the resurrection, and so forth. And the reason for that is they want to highlight different sorts of things. They have a different audience that they're writing to, and they themselves have a different perspective, you might say, from their own background as to what they want to be able to share. And as a result, we get a variety of things as we read the different gospel accounts, and they don't all have what the other one has. One interesting example, I think, in relation to the crucifixion is the famous thing that I know you've heard of many times and probably sat through services on Good Friday, where the seven last words of Christ are presented, right? I don't know that, and I'm pretty sure you don't think about this at the time when you're in a service like that, but seven of them just happens to come out to the perfect number. But three of them are in Luke, three of them are in John, and Mark and Matthew share the other one. So you have to put them all together in order to get the seven last words of Christ. But how do we know which one of those was actually first? I think the short answer is we don't. Another question, how do we know what the order of the seven was? Your turn to answer. We don't. And finally, how do we know these are the only words that Jesus spoke on the cross? We don't. Remember, he was on the cross in this horrific event. He was there for 6 hours. And it wasn't very long till he had loss of blood going on. He was in the sun the whole time without liquid. He's overheated. He's dehydrated. He's probably gradually becoming disoriented and in shock. And in all of those kinds of things mean that it could be that he was calling out things regularly or now and then, kind of like unconscious to conscious and saying something. I think that's significant because one of those seven last words is, as we read that one, my God, why have you forsaken me? I don't know whether you've run across this very much, but there are big debates about what that means. Does this mean that in the deep sense of the Trinity, the Father and the Son are now been divided? Father has forsaken God's Son? Or as some people try to explain it, well, the Jews sometimes simply would give the first word of a psalm. This happens to come from Psalm 22, the first verse. Yeah. And when they said it, everybody memorized back then because they didn't have books. Most of them couldn't read much very readily and there was nothing available to read. So they would memorize and people would know that when he said that, he was really referring to the whole psalm. And if you do that, then you end up through the psalm with a fair amount of positivity as well as this beginning word. So, you know, that's a big, long debate. But I wonder if that one is what came to mind at that point. And interestingly, that's Psalm 22. What are the first words of Psalm 23? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Could be he was trying to recite some of the Psalms. And after this one, he would have said the next one, which would have had a totally different kind of reaction. It is not recorded. There's no way to know. It's speculative, obviously. But it makes sense to realize that we are told a lot of what happened that day, but there are also many things we aren't told. It's only what the given writer thought at that point were the significant things that they wanted to refer to. Just bear that in mind anytime actually you're reading the New Testament or the Gospels, that there are going to be differences because there is a different concern for what the readers need. But what I thought would be useful is to enlarge this as much as we can. And it's enlarged primarily through, there is, in case you're interested, Sandy, do you remember what they're charging for this at Christie's? And an etching of the Thursday, right? Yeah. So that was a couple of years ago. I didn't notice that. But there's a nice image of it on the Christie's site, which Sandy found. And that one I've enlarged somewhat more so that you can see kind of the central figures. Because what I'd like to do is go through the passage, the various pieces of it. We can't do it all. But as we do that, then refer to the, where possible, Rembrandt's painting, because it's not clear whether what's in there to some degree and whether it's certainly not everything completely. But when you see the way it sits there with all of those figures, the other thing it reminds me of, by the way, is, and we'll see this in 2 months, the creche at Christmas time, where we have the baby Jesus with mother, father, and the shepherds are there, and the wise men are there. And if you got a really big one, there might be a couple camels behind them, a couple sheep, and maybe a goat even, so forth, all in this one picture. And of course, the scriptures don't say that they were ever all together like that. They clearly weren't from what you read. But it's a way to bring everything together. And a painter is doing the same thing as the creche does, basically. So a few of the groups. The first group that's mentioned, of course, right at the beginning, is the soldiers compelled a passerby. The soldiers, the Roman soldiers, are certainly there. They're going to be there all day long. They're in charge. And a couple of them are really easily visible. What are they looking like? What's their situation? I'm not saying that very clearly, but without telling you what. Are they standing there? Some of them are, but what are the other ones? On horseback. How many horses do you see? Somebody say three? Yeah, back in the corner there is another one. So you got three horses, right? And just notice how they're kind of all over the place, but the soldiers are there near the cross. They're the guards. The soldier up front, we'll come back to, is down on his knees, and given how the text is written. But yeah, there are a number of soldiers there. And then we're told that they compel a passerby named Simon of Cyrene to carry the cross. It's not clear to me that he's visible anywhere there, that he's brought in any longer. After all, he got the cross there. And if you're forced by a Roman soldier to do something and your presence is no longer required, what are you going to do? Probably get as far away as you can. But we are told, and the interesting thing about the passage I want to mention to you is we are told his name. Not only that, we are told that he has two sons, Alexander and Rufus. That's kind of interesting. Two things I want to mention about that. One is Simon of Cyrene. I don't know how many of you know where Cyrene or Cyrene is, but it's on the coast of Libya today, northern North Africa. And his name is Simon. He has come undoubtedly on the pilgrimage for the Passover. That's why he's in town. And people did not normally come alone. They came in a group, because that towns came together and it wasn't safe to travel alone. And if he's got two sons who are old enough, he's going to bring them along with him, of course. So they are even named. But the fact that they are named or remembered, you might say, suggests that somehow or other they ended up connected to the Christian movement. We know nothing more about them, but if their names are there like that, why is that significant? Because people will recognize Alexander and Rufus and maybe Simon. So in some way, it would appear that Simon heard Jesus during that Passover week, and that he was gradually brought to faith in some way or other. May have been very active in the church. Well, then we're told they crucified him and divided his clothes among them, casting lots. I think you maybe can find that. That's really, remember, this is so small to begin with. This is really tightly done. But I think if you look behind the cross, and it's still vague in this picture, to the right of the cross, there's somebody kind of hunched over. And it appears when you look really closely at the picture, that it's some kind of clothing or blanket or some garment that's being held. And then if you look at the foot, the left foot of that horse by the cross, look down low, that's actually a face peering out. It almost would seem like a joke that Rembrandt is doing, but I'm guessing, and I don't really know, and I've not seen any but he say definitively one way or another where this is, that they're behind the cross and they've been doing this, and the one person is just one and is standing up and the other one is still down on the ground. You can come up with something else if you want. If you go online, you can find plenty of these images and then gradually look through them yourself. And I would really recommend that. It's really fascinating when you can do it. With him, they crucified two rebels, one on the right and one on the left. Rebels, criminals, there's a variety of names that are used for them. It's kind of a term that's used is actually kind of a, it can include a baggage of all kinds of stuff in it. revolutionary, insurrectionist, thief, and so forth. So this text calls them rebels. I tend to call them criminals, so I'll probably say that because it's more general. And obviously, they're mentioned in all four Gospels. This is extremely significant, and that Jesus is in the middle. He's the center of attention, just as Rembrandt makes him the center of attention in the picture. I'm reminded when I think of that, of the time when Jesus is with the disciples and they've been murmuring, and Jesus says, "What are you talking about?" And James and John fess up that they would like to have the best positions in the kingdom. Can we be on the right and the left? We don't care which one, just give us those. And Jesus' response is, "Are you able to drink the cup that I will drink?" A hidden reference, you might say, an allusion to the cross. And in a sense, you know, they're looking for the Messiah to do great things and go sit on the throne in heaven. And Jesus is saying, "I'm going to do great things, but they're going to be great things that are different from what you're expecting. And I'm going to end up on a cross. And the route to heaven is through the cross." That's how this king is going to enter to his throne. Are you able to go there with me? Here are the two who end up in that position, you might say. Luke, of course, tells us more about the one criminal who seems to come to faith. Well, doesn't seem to, he does. But that's not in this account, so I'm going to leave it aside. And then we get those who passed by derided him. They were probably, at least as I look at them, I think they're on the right again, and one of them has his hands up around by his head, and it's almost like he's shouting out, "Yes, question?" Well, a couple. I'll come right back to that. I'm planning to talk about that in more detail, actually. That's the next thing. The whole thing is a bit of a mob scene that's going on there. And some of them are calling out, the bystanders calling out epithets against Jesus. The big one is, "You who said you would restore the temple and rebuild it, come down from the cross," that statement. But then, yeah, what stands out, and I was going to ask this a question, and you just answered that. They're looking away, aren't they? They're not looking at Jesus. One or some people think maybe that's Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, who will be burying Jesus, and it's right at the end, and so they're going down, or they're leaving, getting away from the situation, because down in the corner, on the right-hand corner, and you can't really see it with the enlargement now, there is a big dark thing that under the rock that could be a hole, and that maybe they were going to the tomb. I've read that from one source. Others just call them passersby. And I've kind of wondered if, and this is my little theory, it's also speculative, but I kind of wonder whether Rembrandt might even be making a statement there, because they are well-dressed, they are busy talking. It's as if they don't really care what's happening. They're just going on their way. Two Jerusalem businessmen on their way to make some money. Remember, this 17th century is the golden age of the Netherlands, and Amsterdam in particular. Economically very strong, the Dutch Navy rules the seas. The West India Company over towards, in the Caribbean. The East India Company all the way into Indonesia and beyond. They rule all of that. And so the wealth is just unbelievable, but at the same time, there's very little concern for the poor and the needy. And remember, Rembrandt himself is now on the verge of bankruptcy. He's had a really tough 10 years. And it could be that he's thinking of that as he presents them, because the economy is so strong. There's plenty of wealthy people who could help him or buy his paintings, but they're not doing it as much anymore. Because when the Dutch, one of the things the Dutch were doing was acquiring paintings as a sign and symbol of their wealth. And they wanted them from big name artists, Rubens, Rembrandt, and so forth. And the interesting thing, and I can't not mention this, is so art was collected, but do you know what else the rich folks in Amsterdam were collecting? Tulips, tulip bulbs, yeah. People were paying a fortune to get the bulb from an absolutely beautiful tulip. I was going to say a Bitcoin. Yeah, it's a little like Bitcoin. You speculate. They were speculating with these things. And you'll find all kinds of paintings from this time period of a single tulip growing, and it's been painted. And they're beautiful. The thing that I'm reminded of is, yes, well, that speculation crashed. So be careful if you're into crypto and Bitcoin and things like that. Well, as I said, Rembrandt had been in difficulties for 10 years already. And it's actually only 3 years later that he ends up in bankruptcy. And all of everything he's got, paintings and all the helmets and all the things that he's collected to paint with, or to use in his painting, he bought way too much, his in-laws thought, because it was mostly when he had money, it was hers. So anyway, all of that was then put up for auction in at least a couple different main events. And the sad thing, or the tragic thing from his perspective, was that the art dealers in town, they were good Dutch businessmen too. They got together and they made agreements as to what they would bid on and not bid on. So they did not bid high on, they did not bid even the value, much less more, on all the things that he had. And he ended up with the total amount he got was much less than a couple of his good paintings were worth. Everything was gone. It was price fixing, effectively. And so he was poor the rest, close to poverty the rest of his life. Well, the chief priests and the scribes were also mocking him, Jesus, and they're thinking he's going to be dead soon. So they say, you save people, you can't save yourself. You're the king of Israel, get up from the cross, come down from the cross, and then we'll believe on you. As though that they really intended that. The best you can see is there in black down in the left-hand corner. With this picture, you can get a fairly clear picture of them a little bit at least. But they're waiting. They want to see it all happen. They're enjoying the fact that he's suffering. And notice they're close to the dark. And when you see the next one, they will kind of disappear into the darkness when we go back to the fourth one. But also then there are women who are looking on. The women are at the right of the cross. They're in a little group there. And my question is, they're obviously real close to the cross. What's the text tell us about where they are? Anybody see that real quick? I'm sorry? Yeah, it says the text tells us they were at a distance. That's what we read all the time. The women are away. The catch is, of course, this is artistic license. In every painting I've ever seen, the women are clothes because they are central in as one of the themes of the suffering at the cross. Although it did occur to me literally last night, Sandy, wouldn't it be interesting to have a painting that focuses on the women with the cross at a distance and what they are thinking? Maybe you could paint that. Oh, just a thought. And Mark mentions actually that there are many other women as well as the three that are named. I only do want to mention real quickly that there's only one gospel, actually. You notice the three that are named do not include the mother of Jesus. Two Marys. Mary was a really popular name at the time. It's only the Gospel of John that mentions Mary, per se. That's in addition to the other women. And I just find that, I'm mentioning it because I find that curious. Because of our Christian history ever since then, all the stress that's put on Mary and things like Queen of Heaven and so forth, she's only mentioned in the one gospel as even being by the cross. Make of that what you will, but it just strikes me as a kind of interesting stress. She deserves a lot of credit. I'm not trying to take that away from her. But how we look at her might is kind of tricky, you might say, given our Christian history. And as Sandy kind of pointed to or mentioned, John is actually with right in the middle of the women. There's Mary has fainted. Is that in the text? Well, she's not in this text. That's not in the text in John either. That's another thing that has become part of Christian history, and Rembrandt picked that up, as many artists did, and just added that in. And John then is the one who's comforting her. And that all comes with Jesus from the cross saying, "Woman, behold your son," right? And to the beloved disciple, "Behold your mother." Has anybody noticed the dog that's in the painting I mentioned last, or in the etching? Where at? Lower left, right? Right behind the two passersby. The interesting thing about that dog, cute little thing, is that he's looking at the cross. The two passersby, they don't get it. It's almost like the dog has a spiritual sense that those two people do not have. You could say that's a statement by Rembrandt as well. I think Sandy's language is a, kind of a story within a story. Yes, John.
I think the painting shows a lot of irony, and there's a contrast between the wisdom of the world and faith. Rembrandt's bankruptcy shows a failed artist, and that picture shows a failure on the cross in the world's wisdom. And so I guess from the dog and Rembrandt and faith's point of view, this is a victory, or this is something really good, success or something. But to the wisdom of the world, this is a total failure. Look at that failure hanging on the cross.
Yeah,
I think that's very dramatic.
No, that's true. And that's precisely it's what the gospel is about, right? That's what Paul writes about in 1 Corinthians. Wisdom of this world is foolish to folks, but it's the wisdom of God. Anyway, I think it's kind of a nice touch that he's got the dog. You know, that is very ironic. The dog is looking at the cross. Well, let's move to the other, the fourth state for a bit. As Sandy said, a lot of it is just wiped out. You can hardly see The priests down in the left-hand corner, I mean, you just see the blackishness that was them. It's almost like they've been wiped out. Can you see both thieves? Oh, why don't you bring the microphone back? Can you see both thieves? Almost no. Actually, this is not. If you get really close to it, you know, and you can see the painting on the screen somewhere, there's a little bump of black. It looks like black from that straight line down. That's actually the cross with the other thief, or part of it. So just slightly there, but basically in the dark. You know, virtually in the dark, you could even say. The other one, however, he's in the light, right? So there it looks like what Rembrandt is doing is showing us what Luke had said, that the one has come to believe in Jesus and therefore now is in the light of salvation. John, let's get the mic. Get the mic. It's coming.
Yes, the picture is all black and white, no color.
Say that again.
The picture has no color other than shadings of black and white.
Right.
That's the way it was made that way?
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. There was a black ink, right? Yeah. Some of the reproductions are more brownish color.
Some of the printing inks would be sepia at that time, but generally speaking, Rembrandt used a black ink, lamp black.
One thief. Notice the two guys in the front, the bystanders, the Amsterdam, or the Amsterdam, the Jerusalem merchants that I was calling them. Where are they? They've been wiped out. They're gone. Where's the dog? Also gone. And actually, most of the characters are hardly visible, right? You can sort of tell where the women are, but you can't see them well. And most of the other things are, you know, so much in the dark. It's almost like, and although obviously it's the fourth time he's worked in this plate, it has a lot to do with that. But it's almost like at this point he's blacking things out because he's focusing more on the actual point of death as opposed to all the events in the 6-hour period that he wants to bring in. And at that point, then darkness descends, I mean, really descends on the earth, because the Lord of heaven and earth is dying, or either that or has just died on the cross. The other thing that I find, I just was shocked when I saw this. I mean, shocked in terms of, my gosh, what Rembrandt can do. Look at again at the soldiers on the horses. You can't see the one horse right in the back. If it's still there, it's pretty much washed out. What about the two other horses? Do you notice anything different about them compared to before? For that matter, the riders, the Romans on them. Now let me show you the two together for a second. They stand out more, but notice they are flipped. He's turned them around. Now they are, the horses aren't exactly facing Jesus, but they're aimed at the center, as are the soldiers. And the left soldier on the left was actually facing kind of forward that direction with his head turned towards us. Now he's facing totally opposite direction. Yeah, it's just a reworked plate.
He just reworked the same plate. I was wondering if there was any credibility to the idea that by the time he got to the fourth state, he was so broke that his, you know, he, first of all, he needed to make money. So he needed to get a bunch of these out there. Hopefully people would buy them. And that's all he could afford to do was to use with what he had. So he didn't have a lot of artistic options.
That was my impression. Yeah. Well, like I said, at one point they did think that it was a completely different plate, but I think the analysis was they could see the shadows and how he had changed things. But you also notice, I mean, I don't know about the reproductions, but notice how soft the lines are on the fourth state, whereas the other one, especially the one that Jim had up before, you can see a lot more crisper detail. But yeah, it's because that copper plate is very soft and he rubbed out much of it.
And you had a question.
I'm looking at it on my phone so I can really get close into detail. But if you go back to the side-by-side comparison, there's a guard to the left of the horse on the in the third state who's faceless and no face. I'm not seeing in mine, no eyes, no nothing. It's a head. And in the fourth state, he becomes sort of a different person. If you look at right to the left of the criminal, he's got it's not a crown, but it's a very different person, faceless to a prominent person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, again, I think Rembrandt can add certain amount of detail in the states. He could do that. So, being the fact that was sort of almost a blank, I don't want to say canvas, a blank metal plate. At that point, he could then add the detail. Whereas some of the other places, he took away the detail.
Fascinating, isn't it? Oh, Sandy? Can you, the microphone is... Poor Ted has to run around with Michaels.
It's good form. I'm just curious. This was late 1600s. Is that what you said?
1653 to 1655.
Oh, okay. So there's been a lot of artwork of different artists previous to that, for sure. I'm curious about why the artists never wrote anything. Rembrandt was educated, right?
Yeah.
Why they don't leave something to explain what they were trying to prove or something. You just don't hear that very often. Well, just
there
a historian.
They are
maybe.
Painters, not writers, but I do think he did keep a record of the pieces that he wrote. That he painted and or etched. So those records are probably, a ledger of sorts. So the detail, it would be nice to have a narrative to go along with, but that likely wasn't. There are ledger entries for his art that take it all the way back to the source.
Yeah, but it doesn't talk about.
It does not talk about the specifics. Intent. No.
Yeah. Well, in any case, we're running low. Oh, John.
I would say that a real artist doesn't want to limit the art by putting words on it. Everyone can look at it and maybe get things from it that the artist couldn't get from it. So it wants it to speak for itself. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, I think I've heard that as well. Well, all of this in this fourth state in particular kind of leaves me curious as to, or intrigued, I guess, as to what's going on with Rembrandt's faith in the midst of all of this, if anything. I mean, we don't know. He never talked about it. But as we saw with the prodigal son, the way the early one to the later one, and his life matches those to some degree, and somewhat with the denial of Peter. Also, you could say, moving to this fourth state, he has the opportunity to focus more on Jesus, and he clearly does do that. It's much more centralized who Jesus is and what's going on this cross. And it's kind of like God's light is falling upon and illuminating this one who calls himself the light of the world. Whether Rembrandt's thinking in those terms, I'm not sure. But I do want to say a little bit more about that next time. I mean, as we look at the final painting on the Emmaus Road. I had, in case we had time, which we're not going to really, I'll give you a couple things that you could think about. One is, if you look at this painting or the text, for that matter, and pick a character and think about the characters who were there, which one would you be, do you think? Where would you fit yourself in if you had been in that situation? And in terms of the two paintings together, when you look at those, does one of those speak more to you than the other? Is there anything about it as a whole that grasps you more fully? Those are just things to think about. And then I actually did put together something to send you home with in addition to that, which is what speaks to you most about the fact that Jesus went to the cross at all, if you want to think in those terms. And what does it mean? What does the cross and that reality mean to you at this stage of your own life and faith? Questions we can and should ask ourselves pretty regularly, probably, in our lives. And that, Kujan, you have another?
Hey, we all have a cross. We all have our own cross.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it on the same level as this one, but it's it's a parallel in our lives, in a sense. Yeah. Okay, well, we're just about out of time. So thank you all once again. And as I said, next week's from AS Road. We're a winner.
Thank you.